This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Try to put on the show.
Also the two highest paid quarterbacks in the league. But there is a difference between Patrick Mahomes and Russell Wilson, and it's one that Colin Cowherd says doesn't have to do so much with their ability as their setting. Get to that sound here in just a second.
The difference between Mahomes and Russell Wilson, and they are the two best quarterbacks, one guy is being supported philosophically with weapons, with coaching and schemes, every day. The other guy is saving a deteriorating franchise. Owner, Paul Allen died. Seattle's looking for another one. General manager, Rashad Penny first round. What are you doing? Coach, the defense doesn't work anymore. I mean, Pete Carroll's defense is getting gashed last 2 years.
Good morning. It is Danny and Gallant. It's Monday, July 13th, and that's where we start, Paul. Colin Cowherd saying that Russell is the one keeping the Seahawks afloat, while the Chiefs are the ones who really are turning their franchise over to their quarterback.
Is that entirely true? First off, that the Seahawks are deteriorating when they were the fifth youngest team going into the NFL this past season. But also, number two, aren't the Seahawks doing things to help Russell Wilson out? And I know you're going to say, well, they're not letting him cook, but you go into this season after having drafted DK Metcalf last season. You have two very good, I think, top-of-the-line receivers. And if you end up going 12 personnel most of the season, in principle with Greg Olsen and Will Dissly, I mean, that's probably the best four guys that you could throw out there, maybe in the NFL as far as 12 personnel. There's some other arguments you could make. So it's hard for me to have this doom and gloom look at things the way that Cowherd has.
If Seattle isn't better this year, if Seattle isn't markedly better, then I would say that, because it's kind of been in the same spot the past 3 years. You can put a microscope on the Seahawks and say over the past 3 years, they went from 9-7 missing the playoffs to 10-6 making the playoffs and losing a first-round playoff game to last year where they almost won the division, won on the road in the playoffs, and then went. But really, they've kind of been in that same spot, right, where they're good enough to get in the playoffs, but none of us really think they're that sort of cut above championship contender. It's not like they're hey, this is one of the teams that you really got to look out for. They're contending to get into the playoffs. If they're not better this year, I will see and believe that there is some merit to what Cowherd is saying, which is essentially that Russell Wilson is the one that's getting them there, and they'd be better off. The best chance for them to get past this is to turn the thing over to him as much as possible. In some ways, using what the Chiefs have done with Mahomes as an example.
The difference is Kansas City gets they have an all-time talent. Seattle doesn't. Their offensive lines are bad. They've never had an elite wide receiving core. Their philosophy is anti-quarterback, win the game. They have a Jurassic, and I mean, it's such an outdated offense.
I do like to use the term Jurassic. It's a Jurassic offense, Paul.
I do too, but I mean, yeah, maybe if you take a look at it at first glance, you think to yourself, this is an old school kind of offense, but I do think that there are some offenses across the NFL that are going back towards that old school. They realize that balance is important and that you don't want to have your quarterback throwing a football 40 to 50 times over the course of a game. Maybe Patrick Mahomes is the exception, but even Kansas City was able to find a little bit of a running game courtesy of Damian Williams as the season got down to the end. It's strange to hear this classification of the Seahawks because it does feel like something you would be saying 2 to 3 to 4 years from now. Because I still feel like there's a chance that they can take a step forward, but I guess that's what we have to answer right now. What's more likely for this coming season? For the Seahawks, who are 9-1 in one-score games, to be worse, regression to the mean, or to be better this season? I would assume better, but that's basically because I don't think that the defense can be much worse. And it's also because I don't know that the offensive line, which Cowherd brought up, could be significantly worse than it was last year at times either.
what's at stake this season? That's really what we're talking about. And it's not just, hey, how far can they get? How much better they are? What's this year going to say about the direction of the franchise? And I think it's going to say a ton. I look at the past 3 years, and I believe that the Seattle Seahawks have turned over the personnel on almost every part of their team except quarterback. And they've done it without dipping below 500, which is really impressive. That's really hard to do. Basically, one franchise has done that over the past 20 years, and they've done it consistently in the Patriots. But if they're not able to get better this year, if they're not better than they were, if they're not a better team, and I guess by that I don't even mean they could be 11-5 and be a better team than they were a year ago, have more dominant wins, have better statistical indications, whereas it's not all about we eked out a bunch of nail biters, which is kind of how they got to 11-5 last year. But if they're not a better team this year, I will ask that question of, hey, you do have one of the two best quarterbacks in the league, and while I don't think every team should try and throw it 40 times a game, maybe you should start trying to throw it a little bit more than you do and stop trying to establish that template requires at least a good defense. And right now, any belief that this defense is going to be better this year is really, it's an act of faith. I think that you can point to it and say, hey, I think they're going to be, but it's an act of faith. You're counting on young guys to emerge.
Running game can't hide the defense, because if you run the football a lot, time of possession goes up. And if you do it well, which the Seahawks did do last season, then that does keep the ball away from the opposition and hides your defense a little bit. That defense has to be better. I mean, ultimately, it's going to come down to that. The offense is not a problem, and we continuously get into this let Russ cook discussion. I mean, they had two top 10 units running and throwing the football last year. You can make arguments as to, oh, the passing game could have been a little bit more jazzed up, or they could have chosen not to run the football in specific situations where there was no way that it was going to work. Like when you had Travis Homer and Marshawn Lynch as your number one and your number two running backs in whatever particular order you want to put them in. But the offense isn't the problem. It's about, can they get those young players that they brought in on defense in the 2019 draft, and Jordan Brooks as well, Daryl Taylor this year, are they going to actually make any contributions? If they don't, then they're probably going to find themselves in the same situation as they were last year, and you would imagine that some of those one-score games they end up losing.
And if they do, then I think it's fair to ask, hey, would this team be better off playing games in the 30s and 40s? Because you're right, the run game does hide the defense, but if you're going to run the ball and control the clock, you have to have a defense that can slam the door shut. And right now, the way the Seahawks played last year, it was last guy with the ball wins. Like that was generally how it was. Or last guy with the ball wins unless they miss a field goal at the very end, which, by the way, two last-second missed field goals are the reason the Seahawks were in the playoffs. So if they are going to be better, they have to have a defense that's more capable of playing that style. I don't think you can run the ball and have a tissue paper defense. I think you have to have a sledgehammer on the other side. You can't play it with some sort of, oh my gosh, we're just going to keep them off the field, because then you basically have to have the ball at the end every single time.
After an eventful weekend, where do you think that defense is trending?
Oh, we're going to get into Quentin Dunbar. The world's best. It is impossible to tell what is more inept. Was it the alleged crime or the alleged payoff to cover up the alleged crime by producing sworn testimony? I find it more funny. I don't have the doomsday thing you do about. You don't expect Quentin Dunbar.
I'm operating like he's not on the roster, right? I'm operating like he's not even on the roster right now. Well, what? Look, I'm a cynical person. I may as well operate as negatively as I possibly can in this situation, right? Because I think now you've got to start looking at what actual solutions you can make in the short term. Because this guy was the person that you bring in, and honestly, that was the only reason I could see this defense taking a step forward on paper this year. Dunbar.
He's gonna be fine. The wheels of justice turn slow.
Okay,
we're just fine. It is Danny and Gallant right now. It's time to get to What to Watch For.
What to Watch For every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
The big news in sports this morning is that the Washington Epithets have announced they are retiring their logo and nickname at the end of this review process. Now, they did so on letterhead that included said logo, which is, well, As it was pointed out to Josina Anderson, the key point is that it will be retired, hence why the letterhead still exists. I've seen most people think that Red Wolves is the leading candidate, which is a, come on. I'm rooting for Red Tape or the other Huskies, Washington other Huskies. I think that that would also have some tremendous promise. Washington better than Oregon's. Washington better than Oregon's, I would also like. I would also enjoy those. Paul, what do you think about Washington's new name?
I feel like what they need to do is name the team after an extremely generic president, like the Washington Tafts or the Washington William Henry Harrisons. Because naming them the Washington Lincolns or something like that would be cheating. I want to see a really bad nickname so that I can laugh at it. And I think that because they are up against it, I feel like there's a chance for that. So we can continue to laugh at Dan Snyder.
One of the best mascots in the state of Washington is Lincoln High School down in Tacoma. The Lincoln Abes. Maybe they're in Foss? Yeah, they're down there in Pierce County. The Lincoln Abes is awesome.
That's a good one.
What to watch for.
Kyle Lewis had zero home runs before old Paul Gallant came up to Seattle. Guess what? He's continuing to hit dingers everywhere. Three home runs over the weekend in two intra-squad games. He hit a pair on Saturday, then followed up taking a Marco Gonzalez pitch out to right center in Sunday's intra-squad game. I'm trying not to get too excited about this, Danny, but it's hard not to. I think the big question that we have to answer is how much stock can we put into intra-squad games? Especially when you would imagine as this goes and goes a little bit more, these guys are really going to get a feel for one another, right?
You're just going to kill any sense of joy I have. It was fun to watch, like watching him hammer pitches out. Yeah, no, fun, whatever. Come on. We've been sat here for 3 months not being able to see anything. And now I'm supposed to put things into perspective.
Yes.
I'm here to put things into perspective. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to watch Jared Kelenic bash things down the first baseline and almost take Evan White's head off and get excited. Yeah,
you're going to have to go to Tacoma for that because you can't watch him at the beginning of the season because they're not going to play him this year. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun to watch him hit.
Free Jared Kelenic.
I watch enough of that, and I'm going to start hammering on Jerry every Thursday. I'm like, when are we going to see him? When are we going to see him? When are we going to see him?
He's going to be so annoyed by the end of the season this year.
What to watch for.
The Pac-12 announced Friday that it is moving forward with conference-only schedules. It said it's going to do this in three fall sports: football, women's volleyball, women's soccer. It has not provided details on the shape of those schedules, and it said those will be forthcoming by July 31st. Here's the thing. I don't think there's a guarantee that we're going to get conference-only schedules. I think that they know that the non-conference components of most schedules are not going to be a possibility. So I review this more as, hey, that's at least what we're going to get is that's what we hope we might get, but we're not sure.
A lot of that going on over the course of this college football offseason. Did you see, though, Danny, that Alabama does not believe that the Pac-12 is going to play zero out-of-conference games? Because athletic director Greg Byrne of those Crimson Tide said that the current plan is to play the game with USC. I guess they're above the law.
Well, the whole thing is, it's just posturing, right? And who breaks the contract and whether or not you can get financial. I'm sure that's what it is, and that they don't want to concede any cancellations. Whatever. Dude, if the Pac-12 said they're not playing non-conference games, I don't think USC is going to be on the other end of that game. And they can sort out who's responsible for that and appear to be the tough guys if they want. But there's a lot of ground between now and when that game's supposed to be played. That is what to watch for. Now we bring in the professor, John Clayton, with our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by DivorceLawyersForMen.com.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, we heard from Washington's football team that they are going to change their nickname. There also might be some other news on the horizon with Washington's football team after a couple of firings yesterday. But what's the timeline, do you think, for the team getting a new nickname?
I'd say probably 2 weeks. The fact that Dan, and you knew he was going to change it. There was no choice because, you know, FedEx was going to take everything out of the stadium at the end of the year, and he's got the sponsorship problems with Pepsi and Nike. The three owners want out unless they change the name. So you knew he had to change the name, but now it's a matter of going through at least, I don't know, I'm sure he probably knows what it's going to be. The one hurdle, because I know one of the leading candidates would be Warriors, but he let the trademark, he actually had the Warriors trademark locked up, but he let it open at the beginning of the year. And so I don't know what that plays into it. But, you know, it could be Warriors, could be Red Tails. You know, I think those are two of the, and Red Tails, of course, being tied into the Black Pilots who came out of Tuskegee Institute that was flying in World War II. But I would have to think he's got to move very quickly.
The fact that they are going to retire the nickname, and does that alleviate the co-owner's desire to get out of the team, do you think?
I don't know. You kind of wonder that there seems to be some friction, particularly with Fred Smith and the other two owners. That's still to be determined, but because I think that they, I mean, they've been trying to sell, and I think it's more of the business thing and the relationship with Dan Snyder than it is anything else, but that's to be determined.
The NFL and the Players Association are set to meet today. They're going to talk about a bunch of different issues, which I suppose have not been resolved yet. Daily testing, which the NFL wants to resist. The NFL Players Association wants an acclimation period for players. The NFL still wants a two-game preseason. The players don't want any. The NFL and the Players Association need to work out emergency protocols in case everything goes to heck in a handbasket. We don't know how player opt-outs are going to work, and players also aren't into the idea of escrow payments. Do you feel like we might be on the verge of seeing, John, potentially a back-and-forth that maybe doesn't quite get to baseball versus its Players Association, but gets a bit messy?
No, I mean, it could get messy. There's no doubt because, I mean, they really need to get something done this week. And if not, then I have to think that the start of training camp is going to be probably delayed 2 weeks. But they'll get something done because, you know, you're talking trade-outs. Now, the escrow thing certainly is going to be unreasonable, and that's not going to work. And so, you know, they'll trade off something on that. The owners will. And then, you know, the two preseason games, you know, it's, I think, within the rights of the players to say, you know what, it's not worth it because, again, of injuries and everything else. But I think ultimately they'll work things out. But, you know, there's enough on the plate right now that they might not be able to get everything done. The thing that I think is the most unreasonable thing is the daily testing. And the reason I say daily testing is so unreasonable is because it takes away from everybody else in the country. And it's like, if you're telling me that the players, I mean, again, if they do three, four tests a week, I think that's fine. But I think it's unreasonable in the sake of this country for the players to think they should be tested every day, because all it's doing is taking tests away from everybody else.
John, the one reason that I have hope that this, that the Players Association and the league will work it out is they're not arguing over money. The players want to play for their salaries, and the owners are willing to offer them the salaries. And the reason that the baseball return was so pronounced was because there was a disagreement over compensation. That part, as far as we know, is worked out. So I think they'll probably be able to work through the logistics. I don't expect every player to play, though. I think there are going to be guys that opt out this season. What do you get the sense?
Well, Donovan Smith, the former second-round pick of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, a starting left tackle, he's taken that position because I know his wife is due with a baby in 3 weeks, and he's worried about affecting the baby and affecting the wife. And so he's thinking about opting out, and I'm sure others will. And it's understandable because, you know, it's a risk, and so there will be players that will do that, you know. And then, of course, that's one of the things that has to be settled. You know, like one of the things I'm wondering about, like in the case of Donovan Smith, is that, okay, can you set up like a male maternity leave so that, you know, he can get acclimated with his wife and all that stuff and then be able to come back, you know, miss some training camp. And so I'm wondering if that could be a possibility there. But no, there's going to be players that are going to feel very risky because, I mean, you see it in all the other sports and you'll see it in the NFL.
Per Jeremy Fowler, Chiefs defensive tackle Chris Jones in Kansas City have begun talks about a long-term contract, and it got me thinking, John, about the guys that we haven't really heard anything on recently as far as if they will end up elsewhere. We're getting closer and closer to the franchise tag extension deadline on Wednesday, so Yannick Ngakoue, Matthew Judon, haven't heard anything about them in a bit, and of course you still have Jadeveon Clowney and Everson Griffin hanging around. At what point do you think we're going to start seeing movement in the pass rusher market, especially if Jones ends up going back to Kansas City?
And of course, I mean, I think I don't know if they're going to get a deal done, because I think it's tough, you know, to be able to pay a $20 million defensive tackle, you know, after when you know the cap's going to be at least flat for next year. That could be problematic. But again, at least they have a couple days to do it. But throwing together a deal that's, you know, $4 million over the franchise tag for him is going to be tough. And I think, you know, there's not going to be very many deals done, you know, with the franchise tag people. But you know, I would have to think that as we get closer to camp, then we'll start to see if there's going to be any more movement. But then, you know, so much of the problem is, you know, until they get this thing resolved with the Players Association and the Management Council and the owners, you know, you don't know when you're going to have physicians being able to be available to do physicals. And so until the physicians are available, I think everything's going to be stalled.
Professor, what do you think's going on with Quentin Dunbar? We're going to talk about that coming up. But there are back and forth allegations. Now his attorney is being investigated at the very least for a potential payoff that he may have facilitated or took place at his office.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Dunbar's status is very much in doubt for this season?
I think so, yeah. I mean, again, it's like if there was indeed a $55,000 payout, okay, where'd the money come from? And, you know, why was Dunbar's agent, his attorney, allegedly the one involved with that? Now, if it was some setup to kind of show that, you know, they were being fleeced and, you know, being held hostage to do something. But, yeah, I think this thing just got really messy. And I know in, 48 years of covering the league, I don't think I've come across a story as crazy as this one. But you'd have to think if indeed they did a payoff to drop the charges and that, you know, they've got to be in trouble.
We've all watched crime movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
The
yes.
Incompetence here seems like something you would see in a crime comedy.
It's a Jason Bateman level type comedy career criminal type event where just the most incompetent crooks that you've ever seen.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, but don't you think this is one of the more unusual ones that you've seen? And then, you know, a point aside is, okay, if the claim is that these people were criminals, which apparently they were, and they have a long history of different things, what are you doing over at their places? I mean, I just, that's the thing that kind
Madden
of...
Madden tournament.
Yeah. Yeah, not good.
You know what's... I do read a lot of true crime, and I think I know what happened. Like, I think I have the clues to unravel the entire caper, which might be a reflection on how pinheaded and dumb I am. But yeah, I think I've unraveled it, John.
Okay.
I'm going to tell everybody next.
Oh, you're not going to tell me?
No, I'll tell you a little bit later, but that's a tease to keep the people to the next part.
Oh, okay.
All right, Professor, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
It is Danny and Gallant. We'll unravel the cornerback caper after this.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
If you thought that Quentin Dunbar was going to play for the Seahawks this coming season, you might need to sit and hope a little bit more, because right now, Danny, things are looking pretty sketchy for the guy. If you take a look at what happened on Friday, the New York Daily News released a report about a warrant for access to iCloud accounts of the four alleged victims of the armed robbery that Quentin Dunbar and Giants cornerback DeAndre Baker were at. Well, there is video footage and evidence showing a possible payoff of the alleged victims, which would explain why they changed their tune as quickly as they did.
Yeah, what happened in the case is that the police have continued to work and investigate and look at the circumstances surrounding the change in testimony, where the night of the alleged crime or early that morning, four men told police officers that they'd been robbed by Baker, Dunbar, and a third person. And within 2 days, there were sworn affidavits that were presented attesting to first Quentin Dunbar and then DeAndre Baker's innocence. It's been a weird story from the beginning. And now the focus is what happened between the alleged crime and those sworn statements. And the police, the New York Daily News got documents that were used to support a warrant. So the police are asking a judge to give them access to look for more information. And the information they said they already had was cash, a big bag of cash, being exchanged between one undisclosed person and another guy who was talking to the people who alleged the robbery, the alleged victims.
The bad
man. At the office of the lawyer who represents Quentin Dunbar. Now, he said he did not have any part, did not take part in any potential exchange of whatever, and that what he got were sworn true statements, exactly what he said he had. That's what Grieco's statement has been. There's a whole different thing about his history. The upshot for Seattle fans, though, is that what his lawyer said was a non-case. Now it looks like the reason he said that, there were some, at the very least, suspicious circumstances that led to the affidavits of people saying Quentin Dunbar wasn't involved. It's a big mess, Paul, and I can't decide what was more incompetent. Is it, if there was a robbery that took place, it being two NFL players who left in strategically placed luxury cars without wearing masks, which would significantly impede your ability to get away with said crime, or is it, if there was going to be a payoff, that it would happen and be captured on videotape in an elevator of a law office? Like, that seems, that this whole thing just seems like it couldn't be less competent, strictly speaking, from a criminal expertise perspective.
It's the latter, because if Michael Grieco, the attorney, is a Better Call Saul kind of lawyer, considering the guy's track record, you would think that he would be a little bit more careful, right? He is not. And this is a guy who has got a bad track record, whether it's taking illegal finances as a part of an election.
That was campaigning. That was campaigning. That was as a politician. Like, we're talking about his skills as a lawyer, his lawyering ability. And by the way, I guess he still serves on a county board somewhere. Like, he ran in a post. He might be in a lot of hot water here. As I was listening to it, I thought, is he going to take the Shaggy defense? She even put me on camera. Where just any kind of allegation. The words that I told
her. Wasn't me.
He brought a big bag of cash. It wasn't me. I think I know what happened. I think I've pieced together what happened. Because from the various different reports, the New York Daily News on Friday, and then there was a Miami Herald report, and they're based on sources. One is based on the application for an affidavit, for a warrant. The other one is based. So I think Dunbar and Baker went over to this house, and they were playing in a high-stakes Madden tournament. There wasn't a plan for any. It was going to be NFL guys that were there, and they were gambling, but it was over Madden. They were going to play Madden, and they were there, and some other fellows turned out to be there, and then there was other gambling that was going on, and some sort of dispute broke out, some sort of dispute over who was cheating, who it was, and that's when I think that the guys who felt they were being cheated, which apparently from the allegations were the guys that made off with all the money, were the NFL players. DeAndre Baker, who the victim said had a gun, and Quentin Dunbar, who the victims on the night of the crime were mixed on whether or not he was armed. And then there was a third guy that was there who was definitely, he was told to shoot someone. Yeah, he was told to shoot someone, but he didn't. Then they make their getaway. So the next day, or 2 days, it's 2 days later, a big bag of cash is brought to Quentin Dunbar's attorney's office, according to the police, and given to the guys who had said, hey, we got robbed. What if that was just the stuff that got robbed from them? What if there was an attempt of like, hey, if we just give you back all your stuff, will this be just no harm, no foul? And then we'll all go about our separate ways? Is it possible? Because I honestly don't think if you were an actual criminal, you would be dumb enough to arrange something. Like, this isn't how you do it. If you were going to rob people, you wouldn't do it as an NFL player without a mask on. Like, I refuse to believe that a criminal is that dumb to think I can just grab and run away and go get to my luxury Jaguar and drive off. Like, there has to have been. So I think there was a legitimate dispute over the fairness of competition. I believe that there was an immediate remedy that was imposed by the parties that may have been rash and perhaps supported by firearms in one person's account. And then a couple days later, it's like, what if we just give you back the stuff? Can we not get in trouble? And they're like, okay, fine. And then they're like, okay, nothing happened. And now the cops are like, yeah, that's not exactly how it works. Like, you can't just return the stuff later And we got to get to the bottom of this now. That's what I think happened.
Wow. Danny, the defense attorney, he's back. First client, Vontaze Burfict. Second client, Quentin Dunbar, or perhaps Quentin Dunbar's lawyer. That's a very, I think, wishful approach at looking at this, that the $55,000 that was exchanged and all four victims, alleged victims, gave sworn statements that they were paid $55,000. If that's what they were robbed of, well, great. I guess this is finally over and that Quentin Dunbar is going to be fine. I don't know how anyone can look, Danny, at this case, and I mean the people that are involved, and seeing what Grieco has done, allegedly, and not think to themselves, oh man, this is really messy, and that we're going to have to continue to do digging. And I wonder if, ironically, it's Quentin Dunbar's lawyer that ends up doing him in, more so than the actual incident that took place.
Very possible. Grieco, the lawyer, is the one who responded right away by saying the police sent out a tweet. They celebrated. They spiked the ball after scoring a touchdown. They prematurely celebrated like it had NFL football type lingo in it. And he made a big production out of this didn't happen and there was no crime. And look, it's certainly his latitude to make that. But he created a situation where the police were going to be very skeptical of the information that he'd brought to him, right?
Uh-huh.
Instead of saying, like, let's kind of slow down a little bit. So now you see the sides are dug in. The most interesting thing about the stories over the weekend, and the one in the Miami Herald specifically says it, there's a law enforcement recommendation that Grieco did not do enough to warrant criminal charge. Like, that was separate from the police and separate from the district attorney, but there was an appraisal of did he oversee a payoff? And the conclusion is no. Now, from what the different participants have told the police officers, he let himself out of the room because he was like, I can't be here to see this. So I don't think anybody did. He did what anybody would consider, I don't know about ethical, but it's not illegal. So that question of, and at the end of the day, it's very possible that if Dunbar and Baker end up getting in trouble, they're going to get in trouble over an exchange in which no one was hurt and no one really lost property that belonged to them. Like, it's possible that this will just be the most public fight possible with as many huge, there was a gun involved, there was a cover up, without any actual damage being done to anyone. And if that's the case, it will be the dumbest crime ever.
I think we're almost there already, Danny, because the fact that they covered this up when, as you mentioned, there was no one that was actually harmed here and they weren't able to resolve this on their own after the fact. What did they think was going to happen when they brought law enforcement into the mix? Seriously, what did they think was going to be next? Oh, everyone's just going to get their money back and it's going to be great after the illegal dice game of gambling. Like, oh, it's just going to be fine after this with thousands of dollars being exchanged.
Wasn't me.
Yeah, the it wasn't me defense is going to work out swimmingly. Wasn't me.
But you play in the NFL. It wasn't me.
I mean, just start there. Like, why are NFL players
rubbing each
other?
It wasn't me.
Fair enough. He is Danny O'Neill, defense attorney. I am Paul Gallant. It's Danny and Gallant. The Seahawks have gone back to the future, and Pete Carroll is trying to tell us something that should be enough for the defense. We're going to try to read between the lines of what he said to tell you if it's really when we parse Pete next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Looks like these two cornerbacks just backed themselves into a corner.
Yes.
That one comes from the 570. Looks like somebody's left holding the bag. I guess they really did get a lockdown corner.
Guess they bagged the corner bag.
It is Danny and Gallant and the uncertainty over Quentin Dunbar's. Now, the good news, and he has been granted permission to come to training camp. Like, so he is. It was not contested, so he should be here when the team starts working out and all of that. But that whole, hey, I'm sure that charges won't be filed. I'm sure that charges will be dropped. Doesn't seem like anything's imminent in that respect as they continue to research and evaluate that case down in Miami. Paul, Pete Carroll was on with John Clayton on Friday, and we usually take an opportunity to replay some of Pete's answers and read between the lines. Pete's really good about telling us what's going on. He just doesn't spell it out. Sometimes you have to do some parsing. Pete is an essential, it's a study aid for understanding any Pete press conference. You need to be able to sort of look a little bit between the lines to say what he actually means.
It's a language, and our own Danny O'Neill is a scholar who has been studying this language for years and years. And he said some interesting things, and I would say specifically, Danny, it's when he started talking about Russell Wilson. Because John Clayton asked him about the Let Russ Cook crowd, and Pete, I think, seems to still take some issue with the idea that they're not letting him do that in the midst of effusive praise of Wilson.
Look at all of the successful teams that won all these games again last year. All of them were balanced teams. So we're not going to take anything away from Russell's ability to produce. We want to maximize his opportunity. So whatever this Russell Cook thing is all about, I don't know what that's about, but he is at his best. He is in the most command he's ever been. And he and Shady, the offensive staff, they have worked this offseason, I think, to a point where we are ready to unveil it. The best version of us, and so that means the best version of Russ. And so he's having his workouts. He's working out with guys every day at his place down in the San Diego area. He's been very consistent as always, and he's ready to roll.
Translation: they're not going to pass more on first down, and second and eight, they still might hand it off. What I looked at it is: are they going to overhaul what they do? No. Are they going to try to call a better version of it? Yeah. And Russell does have a lot of control. In one respect, Russell has more freedom than just about any other quarterback in the league. He is allowed to create. It's not just checking at the line of scrimmage. He's allowed to hold on to the ball. They don't freak out about sacks. Most coaches would go nuts with the number of sacks that Russell takes. They're fine with it. They're like, hey, that's a cost of doing business of letting Russell create. I don't think you're going to see an overhauled offense. The other thing, though, is I honestly even think that the people who are advocating let Russ cook, the cooking people, I think they really want just a few more passes in different situations. I don't think it's a case where they want him to average 45 attempts per game. I think it's that in the first half specifically, throw more on first down. Throw more. If you get second and short, throw it. Take more, be more aggressive in that regard. I don't think it's volume. I think it's situation.
That makes sense because, yeah, if we're talking volume, then we're talking about trying to copy Matt Ryan and just throwing a million times over the course of a season, and you hope that makes the offense better. But when you have that balance that the Seahawks have, questioning this unit of all units going into this season doesn't make any sense to me. And yet we're still getting it. Is it because of the way that the first half against the Packers went and because when they decided to let Russell Wilson cook, as they say, they started running routes downfield and letting Russ either throw it or taking off and scrambling, it worked better? But you need balance in this league. I used to be a cooking person before I came here, and since I've been here, I feel like I've seen how the sausage is made, and they need to have a steady serving of both of those.
I can see that. I just... The reality is if you want an offense to be structured like the one Matt Ryan has in Atlanta or even the one like Kansas City has, they're not going to do it while Pete's coach. Like that's not going to, you're going to look for tweaks more than overhauls.
Right. So that was one of the things that we heard from Pete Carroll talking about the cooking people, acknowledging them. He also had some interesting things to say about a return for the NFL. He was fatally optimistic, as he has self-described himself, about the idea that we will have football. But when he was on with John, he sounded very, very hesitant and cautious about the league returning, and even, I think, has the idea that it might not be the worst thing in the world to continue to wait.
Whatever we need to do, do this right is what I hope we do. And so I know everybody's working on it. The league is working. They're going 24 hours a day, it seems, to just try to figure it out and stay ahead of stuff. But right now, if we got to slow down a little bit to get started, that would be okay. You know, and there's a lot of unsettled issues right now between the league and the players. You know, we don't know exactly when how camp's going to be and all of that. They're trying to make those decisions. And as we zero in on it and we gain all the information, we need to do this as well as possible so we can put down a great product and we can really, you know, put our best foot forward. So if we got to postpone, then whatever. I don't know. I don't hear anybody talking about that, but I can see us just waiting a little bit and we'll see what happens.
All the signs are there that it probably isn't going to go off as planned. And Pete doesn't want any part of the discussion, or he's like, tell me when they start and we'll get going. Pete is not someone who tries to get into the what they should do. He's not someone who tries to, here's how the setup should go. He's someone who's like, let me know what the rules are and we'll make the best of them. Like, let me know what the guidelines are and we'll make, he doesn't complain about Thursday night football. It's just, hey, it is what it is. You go and you make the most of it. So I think listening to him there, I think he's seeing what everyone's seeing, which is that the plans that have been laid down over the past month or so have had to change. It's very possible that's going to happen to the NFL, but that he believes that they will be getting going, and when they are, he's going to be ready to go.
It's good to hear. I'm getting more and more skeptical as the days go on, not just because the Players Association and the league don't seem to be that close on a lot of important things that they're going to discuss in a meeting today, but also just because it does feel like there is just too much to be in control of when this does hopefully eventually return. We're still working towards that.
Baseball give you a little bit of optimism? We don't have baseball players that all of a sudden, hey, this guy's been out there. Granted, it's just been a week, but you haven't had a rash of everybody was healthy 4 days ago and now no one's able to get out there. I know that it's going to take spreading within one team and that will change how we feel about it, but the fact that baseball seems to have moved back and gone at least a week without there being major hiccups after the initial testing, I think, is encouraging.
It's encouraging, but we're talking about intra-squad games as well.
Yep.
We're not talking about games between two teams. And also, we've seen this weekend, it seems that we see every single day that there's a soccer game on for Major League Soccer, that it gets postponed. And we saw another game postponed this weekend. So I would like to see this thing come back soon and all, but I don't think that the NFL is as close. And it's interesting to hear Pete, who seemed so optimistic, especially when you heard him on those Talking Coach podcasts earlier when they were first being put on the internet, to where he was there. That sounds like a dramatic change in terms of optimism.
It is, Danny and Gallant. Well, that question of whether or not the Seahawks have catered their offense to their quarterback in the same way that Kansas City did. We've got Brock Heward coming, and Andy Reid's there in Kansas City. I've always wondered what Mike Holmgren would do with a quarterback like Russell Wilson, and Brock's probably the best person to answer that. We'll talk to him about that coming up next in Blue 42.